And today's date is April 19, 1997, the first oral interview of two for Sherner-Gluck's Oral History 405 class, spring 1997. Okay, well, let me start with, why don't we start with a little bit about your childhood background, where you grew up?
I grew up on a situation of the reserve in Southern Ontario, Canada. Born there, lived there. I went to school there. We have a series of interview-day schools from the reservation, all we call the reserves in Canada. And I went to all-Indian school, and I had only all-Indian teachers, and so I had to go away at 14th high school. So it was really a very self-contained community. At that time, we had our own hospital, and we had our own series of day schools. And really didn't go into town very much.
You say your own series of day schools? What does that mean?
Well, it means that we have our day schools that are on the reserve, operated within the jurisdiction of the Cobo.
How many students would be in a school or a class?
Well, it varied. When I went to school and when I taught there, I also taught there, there were 12 schools. Four of them were two-room schools and the rest were all one-room schools. So we had grades 1 through 8 in one room. We were all on the same. When I taught there, I also taught in one-room school. 43 children, grades 1 through 8. Now, when I went, I think there were 25 of us at my school, it's a smaller school. So it varies according to the population. Mm-hmm. But now they've changed it. They have a central school in the village where the children are bused in for grades 7 and 8 before they go up to high school.
Okay. Marilyn.
Yes, I said, okay.
You were taught by Indian teachers
yes.
when you were young. Did you speak a certain language or did you speak English?
We spoke English. English was in school. Although we did learn a number of things in the language, like the national anthem, we sang Oh Canada and Mohawk, these kinds of things. My parents were native speakers.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the language in the house, and unfortunately, I don't have it now. But both my parents never learned to speak English until they were 10 or 11 when they had 1 year of school. So it was a very traditional kind of culture at that time. But I'm talking about, I'm 67 years of age, mm-hmm. so I'm talking like in the 30s and 40s. When there was not a lot of contact with the non-Indian world, really.
Some questions in my head. How many students would leave the reservation after a grade?
Well, at that time, we had to take grade 9 on the reserve, too. We didn't go into high school until grade 10. I think the year that we started, there were 35 of us who went from the various schools. I would say that after the first year, after the end of grade 10, there were probably about 15 of us left. And I was the only one to graduate.
Hmm.
The dropout rate was coming.
Were you, did you live at school or did...
What I did was I worked what we call working for your room and board. I went and lived with the family mm-hmm. and did babysitting and housework for my board and room
mm-hmm.
and went to high school for me.
And was that optional? Were you allowed to stay on the reservation if you didn't want to go?
Well, there was no transportation.
Oh, okay.
So we had to do that if we wanted to go to high school.
Mm-hmm.
There was no option because my parents couldn't afford to pay for any board for me. So if I wanted to go to high school, that was my only option.
What was the prevailing attitude towards leaving the reservation and going to high school? Yeah.
Well, Indian people have always valued education.
Mm-hmm.
So our parents wanted us to go on to school, and at the same time there was that real ambivalence about moving on and losing the culture and moving away. And I don't think it was, I look back on it, and I don't think it was very easy for them at that point. Although they valued education and they wanted us, and I think that's why most of the women, and men too, men went into teaching basically, those who went away to school. There were four of us who kind of palled around together, four girls who palled around together. Three went into nursing and I was the only one who was teaching. And that was because we could go back and live on the land.
And did you go to high school and finish high school knowing that? Was that your
fault? Yeah. And so I went back and I taught. And then I think I'd had a taste of education and I wanted more. And the only way I could get that was to leave. And so that's what I did. Others have stayed there when I go back. The girls who were all nurses are still there.
Are they nursing?
Yeah, they're retiring now, but they were nursing. We had the Indian Hospital, and then they closed that down, and now they have I can't remember the name of it, but it's the senior citizen home in the village.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of them are still working there. They're all RNs.
When you went off to the high school, it was a white high school?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
What was that like?
Oh, it was terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. We weren't at all prepared. We were prepared academically, but not socially.
Mm-hmm.
And coming from a one-room schoolhouse and going into a school where you had to change classes all the time,
mm-hmm.
and different teachers, I was absolutely terrified. I can forget it. I can still see myself walking down this hall and dropping all my books, being lost, not knowing where I was going. And there was a lot of prejudice against Indians.
Well, elaborate on that a lot. Maybe on some personal.
Yeah. You know, the kids kind of made fun of us. Some of the teachers did not like Indians and made it very, very obvious. One in particular was our math teacher. I remember one day so glaringly she sent only the Indian students to the board. There were four Indian students in that class. And she sent only us to the board and gave us a problem to do, which we had not been taught. And I don't think anybody in that classroom would have. And none of us could do it. And she said, well, I don't know why they sent any of you Six Nations in here anyway to the school. You don't know what you're doing. And so there were several teachers like that. But at the same time, there were several other teachers who really were, you know, I can remember our French teacher. She was just really wonderful with us.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did well in French, and she praised me in front of the whole class. So there was that. But there was also this other underlying element. And even I made friends with one of the white girls at school. We got to be very close friends because I was staying in town. So you'd go and get a Coke after school or something once in a while. Didn't have to be right back to the house. And I remember I stayed in town with her one weekend and we went to the movies and did things. So then I asked her out to my home and her parents went to
the home you were staying at?
No, on the ranch.
On the ranch.
Yeah. And her parents would not let her come.
Interesting.
Yeah. And she had said that her mother and dad had said, I was a very nice girl and I was welcome in their house, but they did not want her home. So things like that that came through, and that's out and out prejudice.
Yeah.
There were those incidents.
Were you at all prepared for that before you left the reservation?
Not one little bit. Not. And that was just amazing to me. And one time I went home and I asked my father why. I said, why don't white people like Indians? That was my perception as a 14-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here I am 14, I'm living in town,
okay,
taking care of somebody's house, they're doing their washing and their ironing and their cleaning and their cooking and taking care of their kids. And I stayed in one weekend and went home every other weekend. And that was my own perception. Why don't they like us? Well, and his response to me, I think is probably the best one that's ever been given, is they don't understand us and they don't know us. And that was very insightful, I thought, from my father, who had spent 1 year in school to learn English language.
And, how often would you go home?
Every other weekend.
Really?
So I'd be there for 2 weeks, because I'd stay one weekend so they could go out and do things while I took care of them.
Do you feel like, when your father said that, do you feel like when you left, by the time you left high school, that people you had encountered maybe understood you more?
Yeah, some of them did. But just like this one friend of mine that I had met, and her parents wouldn't let her out. Well, after I left and she married, the first time I came home for a weekend, she came out to the red light to my home to see me.
When she was an adult married?
Yes. Yeah. So there was that understanding. But I thought basically, you know, even though I had met friends, it was never that visiting back and forth, except with her.
When you were working for your room and board, did you feel, for lack of a better word, maybe subservient?
Oh, yes, definitely.
How was that environment like for you on a daily basis?
Well, you know, I was treated as a servant in the house. That's what I was. I was a servant in the house, even though I was going to school. And I remember clearly one day, and in Canada at that time, in Ontario, we had what we called provincial exams. So that, starting at the end of grade 10, you had to take some exams, which were province-wide. The same exam was given to all grade 10 students at the same time, same day. So I was studying for those. And then at grade 11, and the same all the way through. Well, one day when I had been studying, and I came home from school, and the lady I was working for had a luncheon party. And the place was a mess. They hadn't put a single dish away. Even the butter was melting on the dish. And I was to clean all this up, cook dinner, feed the little one because they were going out. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I think, was the worst I ever experienced. And I just really felt it. Yeah. I was a maid, and my school was secondary. Go on. Because what I really had, you know, I guess whether it was my expectation or whether it was my understanding or what, that my school came first, and that was secondary, but it was not in the house.
What was your risk? I mean, did you do the work?
Yeah.
Did you say anything? Were you in a position to?
No, I was not in a position to say anything, because I couldn't drop out of school.
Did you stay with them the whole
time? I stayed with two families. I stayed with one for 2 years and another for 2 years.
And were they both sort of employers?
Yes. They wanted a maid. They wanted a cheap maid. They paid me $1.25 a week. And in those days, that didn't buy anything either. When you're talking about 43, 44, that sure didn't buy anything. But, well, that was, you know, that was the price that we had to pay in order to go to school. And many of us did it. And I think that was probably the reason many of the girls went there.
It sounds like emotionally it was a very divisive time for you.
Well, it was, because if you figure what adolescence is, and then you're wrenched from this closed community, this warm, nurturing environment, and then trust it. It's terrifying. It's not the only way I can think of.
I want to back up a little bit and talk a little bit more about your life on the reservation as you were small. Mm-hmm. Who lived in your home?
My mother, my dad, my brother, and myself. We have four. I have two. I had two older sisters. They're both deceased now. And my brother and myself. Well, my older sisters were married and out of the house. And we're all very far apart in age. My older sister was 20 years older than I. Mm-hmm. Then my next sister was 13 years older than I, and my brother is 7 years older than I, and then I'm the fourth one. So he left when he was 17 to go to work in Niagara Falls. And so then at that time, I was going with my husband. And we had a little house. Started off with the one room. Kind of my dad added on a room on the other side and kind of divided up what was there for bedrooms. So we were poor. We didn't have any electric light, any running water, any indoor plumbing, anything. But I guess I really didn't know I was poor until I left and saw what other people had. Because eventually we had a good time. You know, we ice skated all through Canada, ice skated in the winter, and in the summer there was plenty of work to do because my dad farmed. So I worked on the farm all summer. And we had a lot of activities. You know, our religion is the Longhouse religion. And my mother was a Christian and my dad was belonged to the Longhouse. So I went to church with my mother and then I went to the Longhouse with my father. And so I'd go to the ceremonies with him. And there was a lot of visiting. People visited back and forth. And I don't know, it was just always seemed to be nice things to do.
Now visiting, does that mean like at night, after
the ceremony? Or even during the day. You know, it's one of the things I think about Indian people is that people are very important. So if people come in, you drop what you're doing and you visit. It's not that, well, I've got this to do and I don't have time for you, like we've become very much so in the modern world. So there's always plenty of time for visiting. Because you can always get your work done when you're there.
When, that's wonderful. did your father farm his own land, or did he work for another?
No, he farmed his own land. Once in a while, when we were short of money, he would go off and work for some of the white farmers surrounding the land. And my mother would go and do day work in town, clean people's houses.
And did she do that always, or just when you were short of money?
For several years there, she did it regularly. And then after things got a little bit better, she didn't do it as much, but she did it for quite a period of time.
Now, did she speak English at this point?
Oh, yeah, they were both English speaking, but they both talked the native language while they talked both Cayuga and Mohawk.
What is the other language, Mohawk?
Mohawk and Cayuga. We are Cayuga. Yeah, with my mother and dad.
Did you have a family that lived around you on the reservation?
Oh yeah, my mother's sister lived across the road, and her cousin lived next door, and it was really all my mother's relatives that lived around us, all female relatives.
What was that like?
Oh, that was fun.
How is that? I mean, what kind of when you say female? I mean, what sort of roles did the women play in?
In the Six Nations, we are a matrilineal society. And basically, traditionally, we're matrilocal because everybody lived in one longhouse. Subdivided up so that clan members and we belong to the clan of our mother. So my mother was Turtle Clan, so I belong to the Turtle Clan. And my dad was Bear Clan, so we did not belong with the Bear Clan. So the women around there all owned the property. We lived on my mother's property. And across the road, her sister owned the property. Down the road was my mother's another cousin who owned her property. Next door was another female cousin who owned her property. And so I always, after I studied anthropology, I didn't know all these things, but after I studied anthropology, I would classify really as a modified matrilocal residence pattern at that time.
Was it strange for you to go out off the reservation and realize that life, not only the discrimination and the style of life, but just that men were sort of in charge of, I mean, you know, in charge of
Yes, that didn't hit me until later, I guess, because, you know, I really wasn't all that much into what was going on in town, except for where I lived, because other Indian students were around, and we chummed together all the time. So I was really in that Indian environment. And it wasn't until I left the reserve permanently that I really began to see that, hey, you know, I was usually seen as a pretty assertive, forceful person, even in those days when it was not at all popular. And because we never thought about it. That was the way things were. Mm-hmm. Women have a lot of power in our culture. And traditionally, the clan mothers, well, today still in the longhouse, the clan mothers are very strong. Mm-hmm.
What type of power? What type of
choice? Political power, social power. Political in the sense that the clan mothers choose the clan speakers. Mm-hmm. And if they don't make wise decisions, the clan mother has the power to remove them. Mm-hmm. And before they had the elected council, that was the system that was in place. That was the decision making. And the men didn't go to make decisions unless they first of all talked it over with the clan mother. Yes, they were the central niles. You know, when I look back on that now, you know, study decision making and political power and things, you really began to see that that was a much more balanced relationship. That women had a role to play, men had a role to play, but it was a shared governance.
Mm-hmm. Versus the
patriarchal system. And I think that's one of the reasons why in many parts of the country they call we Iroquois women as pretty bossy and bossy because we don't back down.
Because you're used to having the power. Was it in your lifetime? I mean, it was during the 40s period when they went to elected council?
No, in the United States, they went to the elected council in the 30s, mm-hmm. the Indian Reorganization Act of 34. Right. In Canada, it was 1927.
Oh.
So it was before I was born. And my dad's father was one of the last traditional chiefs.
Mm-hmm. Did you know him?
No, I did not. He died before I was born, around the time. I did not know him.
How involved were you with tribal things like events? I don't know how else to term it. Festivals or events? Or
my family were very involved, my mother and dad. We had an Indian fair that was held mm-hmm. every September. My father was president of the fair board for a number of years. It was an Indian women's organization, and my mother was president of that several times. And they were really community-oriented in terms of, well, the fair, of course, was to promote crops and flowers, and the school children had a whole separate component where we exhibited our artwork and all our crafts and handwriting and all kinds of things in the school. So it was just, it was held in September, the end of September, and we all look forward to that every year. And then they also had a plowman's association, I'd forgotten all about that one, where plowing was judged, who was the best plowman. And my father was president of the plowman's association a couple of times. And that was a big thing at that time. One of our young boys from our res won it for Across Canada.
Wow.
He was the best plowman in Canada. And he was sent to England to represent Canada in a plowing exhibition. So if there were things like that, and then they had lacrosse all summer long. There were various lacrosse teams that played and all winter long. Of course, they had a hockey team.
A reservation hockey team?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was very much incorporating the outside sports.
Yes, yeah. And then every Sunday afternoon, there was always a lacrosse team, a lacrosse game of just Indian teams. They didn't play with the non-Indians on Sunday afternoon, so it was just the Indian teams playing one another. And so they come from different Iroquois reserves, or we'd say Six Nations. Different Six Nations, they might come from over from Tonawanda or Tetavog, and they played, and our guys would go over there and play. So they had this Indian lacrosse league that played all the time.
The questions are just spinning. Let's see. Let me back up here a little bit. You talked about your mother and father being two different religions.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you?
Yeah, I never thought about it at the time. As I said, my mother was an Episcopal, or the Church of England in Canada. And her mother had been Church of England, but her father went to the Mono. So it never created a problem up there because there was that acceptance of. And that's one of the things that, looking back on, I find that Indian people are very tolerant of other religions. It's not a thing that we find is a major issue. My mother always taught me that it doesn't make any difference what one believes. She just did not like people trying to proselytize. She felt that what one believed was that person's own choice, and we had to respect that. And my father, of course, is very strong in that way. You respect all whatever people
do. Did your father teach you or involve you in any of the...
I used to go to the longhouse with him. Yeah, and it was really funny because he'd say to me, go in this door and sit over here. So I would go in and sit down. He'd always come in the other door. So one day I said to him, how come I go in here? He says, because that's where your clan sits. I understood, well, that's where my clan sat. So, and it was the same clan as him. I thought that, you know, he was their clan. So you learn these things. But with Indian children, you know, there was never any just, well, why do I want to do this and I don't want to do that, and just do it.
Obedience was very...
Yeah, yeah. And there was never, and I didn't do it because I was afraid of him, because he was a very gentle man. I just did it because that's what was expected.
What type of religion did you take away from the reservation?
I would very strongly say that I took away from the traditional system. Oh yeah, it fit more into my own way of thinking, my own way of living. And I had said one time to my mother that you're a sinner, and I look back on this now, and I said to her, you know, Christianity really isn't for us because it teaches us things that we shouldn't really do. She never argued back with me, but it did bother her, I know that. But I strongly felt that. I felt that what I got from the longhouse religion was much more. There's no hierarchy. I said to her, there's nobody standing up there in the front telling me what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah.
And we do because we know we're supposed to do, not because somebody's telling me I've got to do it. And I didn't realize that at the age of 14 this really bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
That he's up there and he's telling me how I'm supposed to live and what I'm supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at the longhouse, you do it because that's the way you live.
Can you describe a little bit more about the longhouse religion?
Well, the ceremonies are held at agricultural times. It's very much in tune with the cycle of the year. In the winter time, we have the midwinter ceremonies, which is, you know, at that point, the salt face dance, the feather dance, all various kinds of things went on all week. And then after the snows and the planting came, before they planted, they would have a seed ceremony. You bless the seeds and before you do the planting, and then as they come up, you thank the Creator for bringing you these crops. And then then the strawberries come on, and I always loved strawberry festival. That would be, and then the strawberries would come on, and then the corn would come on. Corn was a very essential part of our culture. And then there was always the green corn dance, and I actually loved those green corn dance. And then the fall, you have a series of Thanksgiving, and all our ceremonies are Thanksgivings to the Creator for bringing us what we have received from this cycle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why did you like the green corn dances from that?
I don't know why. It was always, it always seemed as if people had, and maybe since, because corn was so central to our culture, I could think of all these ways we fix corn. Green corn, that's when the corn first comes on, and we used to grate it and bake it and then dry it, slice it, and then dry it out in the sunshine, and then put it away, and we used to just use brown paper bags. Mm-hmm. And then in the winter, just cook it up, and we'd have that for breakfast or sometimes for dinner. And so corn, there was so much to corn, but it always seemed to me when we went to the green corn dance, the people were always very joyous. I don't know what it was, because maybe the corn crop was good, you know, or what, I don't know. But it always seemed to be, to me, one of the very joyous ceremonies.
Yeah. Can you, do you know, are there any ones in particular that has a good memory for you?
No, I could just think of all of them at that time. And then, of course, I used to love to go to the, like I said, strawberry festival, and I liked the midwinter one. I think as a kid, too, I like to go, okay, good food. Okay. Eat it all eat. And then false face dance, and have, we'd have false face mush, and oh, and I just, oh, I just love false face mush.
No, but what is that, false face mush?
Well, it was just corn cooked up, mm-hmm. kind of, like a, the consistency of oatmeal, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
I keep thinking of grits as you talk.
Yeah.
Grits, but
yeah, no, it's not like grits. No,
it's a little different.
Yeah, a little different, yeah.
It sounds like your father's religion had answered more for you.
Yes, it did. It did. It, because I felt that there was room for everybody in it. There was not one person, although there was a speaker that rotated, the speaker of the longhouse rotated, so anybody could get up and talk. And then you danced, and then you ate, and it, I mean, it was just much more involved kind of relationship.
Did it, was it more incorporated into your whole life?
Yes. Oh, I would say so. Rather than just Sunday morning at 11 o'clock.
And you had talked about when you were 14, sort of having a realization about your mother's religion.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that?
Oh, I just, that's what I said. You know, why do we have this man up here telling us how we're supposed to do? That the Indians shouldn't be Christians.
So
I made it very strong at that point. I'm mellow, of course, you know. But, you know, when the 14-year-old comes to these realizations. I just said Indians, we have our own religion, and that's what we should be.
So you're strongly identified?
Yes. Yeah.
And did you ever go back to a Christian church while you were on the reservation?
No. Didn't go back. I've been a few times since for funerals and other things, and the last time I was in an Episcopal church was about 2 years ago, a friend of mine died. She was very strong in Episcopal. And I bought French from that Episcopal church. And I just felt, as I sat there, you know, it took me back, as I said, you know, they say deja vu all over again, you know. Took me back, and all the ceremony, and it's nice, all that ceremony and everything else, but it's such an awful. I really don't belong in this. I really don't. That was just beautiful. The Episcopal Church is lovely. But again, it's that all the trappings, I think, bother me. All the vestments. And, you know, it just somehow or other doesn't sit right with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, you know, Now, even though I'm getting old, I don't think I'll go back to the Episcopal Church.
I can understand. I need to really focus here. I just go off on tangents. Let's see, we talked about your religion, we talked about your household, and we talked about... I really want to talk some more about what that transition from the reservation to town life was like.
Oh, yeah, well, as I said, well, fortunately, there were a number of us Indian girls the first couple of years, but they all dropped out, so that we had our own little social group.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do very much because we all had to go home to clean house and take care of kids and somebody else. But we supported each other in our loneliness. I think one of the salvations that I had, and it's probably, as I said, has carried me through probably even until today, is I love to learn. I like school. I love to read. I love ideas. And I think that that was one of the things my transitioning into the non-Indian world, which is why all my lifetime I'm still connected with learning. I think that kind of looking for explanations, looking for reasons, looking for... I took my undergraduate degree since I've been in San Diego, I have another. I took my bachelor's in anthropology, then I have a master's in sociology, then I have another master's in counseling psychology. And I said, you know, that probably was that circle of the culture. And I went into sociology to try and understand American society because a lot of it didn't make sense to me. Then I came back to the individual in psychology and tried to put all these together. I think that's what has saved me all through, I think, because I do love to learn.
Didn't you find a conflict within the education you were receiving in school?
Oh, yes. But I think that's why I kept on learning. What is this conflict? You know, I was just rereading Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. He says, life is full of conflict. And it's what we do with these conflicts that give us meaning. And yes, there were many conflicts. I'll never forget. Well, I had a lot of conflicts in anthropology. You have no idea. and then after I finished my anthropology degree, I went into education. I figured I taught on the land. Not like teaching. Still love teaching. So I decided, I'll go back and get my teaching credential. That was after the Ryan Bailey. I went back and I took two classes in education. And I couldn't handle it. That, by that point, I couldn't handle it in my life. One of the teachers I had, one of the professors I had, and I think it was the ideological and philosophical foundations of education. And I kept raising questions. Friday, he looked at me in utter frustration and said, we always have to deal with your value judgment. And it was true, because I would say, well, that might be fine when you're looking at it from this point of view. But, you know, there are other cultures, there are other ways. And not all people believe the same way. What do we do in education? And I'm talking about the mid-60s at this point, when there hasn't been all this change. But I felt it so strongly. Yeah, and there were conflicts when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
There's always been conflicts. I don't felt that I would say something and people would look at me like I'm too bad. And I'd wonder what was going on. And then it would come out that, well, you know, you really can't judge people that way. You really have to think about where they come from, what their belief systems are. And people would just, there was this tunnel vision.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always kind of questioning. And so I think that's what helped me, getting back to your original question. That's what really helped me through high school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I read stuff. I had no idea what I was reading. You know, some of the old English novelists and everything else. But I tried to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to learn. And I was very good in things that I did, like French and math. I was excellent in math and sciences. And yet, it was interesting that I ended up more in social sciences and history, which took a lot more reading and a lot more understanding. That's what I ended up in.
Maybe those kept conflicting, but kept searching.
Kept searching. I think maybe that's why it's man's search for meaning. is what we talk about.
You said you started out with about 35 fellow students from the res, and by the time you graduated, you were the only
one. I was the only one.
From your class.
Yeah.
But there were still younger.
Yeah, there's still younger ones coming in.
What was that like for you, year after year? You go in and just, like, they're just dropping off.
Just
slowly.
Dropping off. And, well, I think also what, you know, the thing that was hard for me is that they would want me to be with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't. And so, well, you know, you're just getting to be more white.
Mm-hmm.
Here you are at school studying, and you're just getting to be more like the white people. So that was hard. That was hard from an Indian point of view. And it was lonely for me because, you know, I didn't have all that many friends. Not Indian. And so I think that's really why I got into the whole learning. It's a good escape, you know? I said that to somebody a couple of years ago. I said, you know, my escape has not been into drugs, alcohol, or anything else. It's been into learning books.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my escape mechanism.
Who were your role models during all of this?
Oh, probably my mother has been a major role model in my life. You know, as I said, she was just a very strong woman. You know, she was a housekeeper, a cleaning woman. She always wanted me to set my sights higher.
Mm-hmm.
She always wanted me to go on to school, do something. And as far as the teachers in school, probably the one I admired the most was the French teacher. She's a very domineering kind of person. But she really made us learn French. And she was a very good teacher. I felt that, you know, giving, she didn't seem to be in any way prejudiced against anyone else.
Did you find that when you would come back to the reservation on the weekends or you'd have the encounters with your family, did you find that even though they really wanted you to learn, there was still sort of divisiveness to that?
Yes, because I think the more you learn, the more you grow.
Mm-hmm.
And in a traditional culture like that, there's not a lot of change.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it became difficult as I learned more and more and more and wanted to expand.
Yeah. How did you deal with that?
I guess the way I've always dealt with it with my family right up to today is I didn't discuss it. I let that be part of my life and this be part of it. Because I knew that it might create conflict with the family. I can handle the conflict away from the family much better. I did not want to have conflict with the family.
Mm-hmm.
So I just didn't discuss it. I just didn't talk about these things I'd learned or anything else. I just kind of, and it's kind of nice to go home and settle back into comfort,
mm-hmm.
where you don't have all these other things kind of things going on. The same way still, I just lost my older sister last year, and I went home every summer. And it would be so comforting to just kind of be with a big family reunion, and we were just all back to where we came from. And there's no questioning and no emphasis on, well, you know, you're the only educated one. They never ever said that to me. Because I'm the only one who graduated by school. That was never said to me. Once in a while there'd be a question, well, when you were in college and this kind of thing. But it never created that kind of, I think it becomes much more internal with the person who's changing and growing and leading. I think it's much more an internal problem than it is with the family.
So that then, if you can think back to when you were in high school and then going on higher education, what was that like inside?
Confusing, wondering, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to leave this? Maybe I should just go home. I've thought about it many times.
What is your role? What was your role when you come back? Did your role change, I guess?
No, I think that's the comforting part. Your role doesn't change.